It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 694 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, Damian Duffy from Parable of the Talents talks about his recently released sequel to Octavia E. Butler's Parable of the Sower. Damian was chosen to continue his successful work of translating Butler's prose into the comics format, once again working with artist John Jennings. The book is described this way. This book follows Lauren Olamina, a preacher's daughter who develops a new religion called Earthseed while traveling the dangerous and dystopian country. Duffy and Jennings bring the sci-fi classic to life with a beautifully drawn graphic novel adaptation. Parable of the Talents continues Butler's masterful story set against the background of a war-torn continent under the control of a Christian fundamentalist fascist state. We discuss how this book came to be, who the various characters are, and what else we can expect from this high-power writer-artist team in the months ahead. Published by Abrams Comics Art, this graphic novel can be found in local comic shops, in your local bookstore, or on Amazon.com. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what Damian has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. Octavia E. Butler's 1993 dystopian novel, Parable of the Sower, painted an alarmingly poignant picture of the year 2024, introducing readers to a world shaped by environmental disasters, economic instability, and social unrest. Following Lauren Olamina, and I probably butchered that, a preacher's daughter who develops a new religion, Earthseed, while traveling the dangerous and dystopian country, Damian Duffy and John Jennings bring the sci-fi classic to life with a beautifully drawn graphic novel adaptation, and probably well written too. Now they're taking on the sequel to Butler's stunning novel, which is called The Parable of the Talents, which follows Lauren's daughter, Asha Veer. That's probably mispronounced too. The Parable of the Talents continues Butler's masterful story set against the background of a war-torn continent under the control of a Christian fundamentalist fascist state. Asha searches for answers about her own past while struggling to reconcile with her mother's legacy, who is caught between her duty to her chosen family and her calling to lead humankind into a better future among the stars. And today I have the privilege of talking with Damian Duffy, who did the writing on both of these things. How you doing, Damian?
I'm great. Damian? I'm great. Thank you for having me.
It's good to talk with you. As I said to you before we started to record, I have not had the chance to read these good things, but I'm sorry about that. I'd really like to, but
that is okay.
Real life gets in the way of comics every once in a while, and we've got to do other stuff.
Yep.
So, have you written adaptations in comics before? Or is this your first time?
The Octavia Butler ones are kind of the first ones. Before I did that, I wrote an adaptation, actually that John also did the art on. I wrote an adaptation of a short story that John had written that we turned into a comic for an art show about autobiographical comics. This was many years ago. And then I also adapted a poem about Hurricane Katrina into a comic, but Octavia E. Butler's Kindred was the first time I'd adapted a full-length novel to a comics work. And then Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents were our follow-ups to that.
Very good, very good. So I don't know if I ask because, you know, Norma, is Octavia still with us or
no.
Has she passed on?
Unfortunately, no. Okay. She passed in 2006. There's some, I'm not exactly sure that I think she might have had a stroke or a fall. Those things.
Yeah, unfortunately, we start to get older and these things start to happen to us.
We do, yeah.
Bad news with all that stuff. But the good news is, of course, these are helping people access a new audience, or at least a larger audience, hopefully.
I hope so, yeah.
Especially with because comic books and stuff like that. And science fiction is the perfect place in comics because you've got an unlimited special effects budget.
That is true, yes. And this Parable of the Talents, more so than Parable of Sower, let us do things that are a little bit more science fictional. This Lauren Alamina's story, which her childhood is Parable of the Sower, and then parts of Parable of the Talents talk about her adult years. Those are like much more grounded and realistic. So like we also had to depict it in a more grounded and realistic fashion.
So, yeah. So, of course, now you've got experience with this. Your third book of hers that you've been adapting. So I imagine that her estate or whoever is doing that is must be happy with your work because they've got you doing it three times.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we've been really fortunate to work with the Butler estate and Merrily Heffert's Butler's literary agent while she was alive and now the estate's agent. We've been really lucky. They've been very supportive of the books and complimentary, and that's all we can hope for.
Really? Well, that's the best endorsement you can have is when the people who represent their legacy, wants you to do it, keep doing it. So that's a good thing. Let's see. I got to read a summary of the book. I haven't read the book itself, but according to what I understand, this book starts out and correct me if I'm wrong, California in the 2030s.
Yes. So there's kind of a framing narrative, and that's Lauren's daughter Asha. And she's speaking from far in the future after her mother has died, and kind of relating her mom's life story from kind of her early 20s on. So the Lauren Alamina parts, those begin in the 2030s, yes. And she's kind of become, in Parable of Sower, she's a teenager. In this one, she's, I think, 19 or 20 at the start. And she has become kind of a community leader, but also a religious leader. Lauren Alamina sort of, she says she doesn't invent it. She just kind of uncovers or discovers it. But she has this belief system called Earthseed. It's sort of, its main tenet is that the only lasting truth is change. And all that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. It talks about this idea of God is change. And it's actually a fairly like kind of rationalist, religious doctrine. 'Cause it's not like setting up like a God of change, like Thor's the God of lightning or something like that. It's just, recognizing that the force of change is something that's like always present and kind of unstoppable. Although you can kind of shape the way it goes through, forethought and planning and stuff like that. But then the ultimate goal of Earthseed is interstellar travel, the idea of founding human colonies on other planets as a way to keep the species going while the Earth is degrading.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I was reading the summary, and it says that in 2032, Andrew Jarrett is elected president.
Yes.
He's also the leader of a fundamentalist religion called Christian America, and his supporters violently oppose anyone who does not follow the religion, which doesn't make sense, but that's what it is.
Yeah.
And Jarrett and his followers fixate on returning America to an idealized vision of traditional values, including rooting out all other religions and promoting subservient roles for women.
Yes.
So in 2033, Acorn is attacked and turned into a Christian America re-education camp where individuals are enslaved using shock collars, forced into brutal labor, raped, and tortured. That sounds like a nice group. The Christian children, including Larkin, are taken away, and a Christian America family adopts Larkin in Seattle. I don't see that happening, where she is renamed Asha Vera Alexander. So that's kind of the basics of it. Stuff.
Like yeah, that. Yeah. So it's it starts talking about the Acorn community, kind of picking up from where the first book ended. And over the course of the book, you find out, you know, how Asha was forcibly taken from her mother, and then sort of the estrangement that came from those events happening. It unfortunately there's a lot in these novels that echoes present day politics, echoes just the way people have always tended towards divisiveness in some way or another, but is definitely quite present in the real life historical moment, but then also in sort of what Butler was envisioning as a warning for the future.
So what was it like adapting this? Because there's some things that one could say is happening now.
Yeah, that was probably the biggest difficulty with adapting these. Having already had the experience with the novel, with adapting Kindred into a graphic novel, I had a better handle, I felt, of like the technical aspects of, you know, what things could be cut out so that we could fit in our page count. And sort of where edits could be made that still, while still maintaining the spirit of the original story. But just the fact that this thing written in the 90s as this warning of a dystopian future that we'd be headed for if things didn't change. And then looking on social media and sort of seeing that the news was pretty close to what was happening in the books. It was overwhelming in a lot of ways, but also I think kept us motivated to keep working on the project, since it does have a lot to say about present day politics and sort of the dangers of allowing fascist ideologies to take root in a democratic republic.
Okay. Do me a favor, because I have trouble getting people, when I ask this to people, they have trouble identifying. How do you define a fascist?
So fascist would be authoritarian leadership based around a shared nationalistic or ethnic identity, usually like with a charismatic leader within whom all governmental power resides. I think that's as close as I'm getting to the textbook definition off the top of my head.
Okay, so it almost sounds like a cult.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a cult at a national level, I think. But I mean, you could say that about a lot of different, I think, systems. Fascism in particular is also very, focused on like centralized government, on surveillance of the people in the country, eliminating forms of dissent, and just that sort of consolidation of power.
So it's how did you know when you went through what you could remove and what you couldn't? Do you have to keep your eye on the prize, you know, when you're looking at the end? And if it doesn't help at the end, do you have to kind of take it out sometimes? Or how did you approach that?
Yeah, the first thing I had to do was read the novels, 14 or 15 times. And the reason I do that is because I wanted to feel like I had a grounding, not just in like the plot points, or sort of like the obvious emotional moments, but then like the subtext underneath that, or like metaphors, or the different kind of literary techniques that were at play. So I could figure out, you know, what was really necessary to get the emotion of the story across. And also figure out ways to, you know, perhaps do the same things with subtext or metaphor that Butler did in prose with comics art. So finding visual metaphors or visual ways to sort of bring that same subtext along.
Because I'm an editor by trade, and I have had to. The biggest trouble I have as an editor is some people want me to rewrite their stuff so it sounds like I wrote it.
Right.
And I'm always telling them, no, my job is to make you look good. I always tell people, editors are like Batman. We prefer the shadows. We don't, our job is not to make us look good. Our job is to make you look good. And so I've run into editors who don't agree with that. And I'm always surprised because that's not the way, especially, and I imagine you had to deal with those kinds of things too. So were you tempted at some point to try to, or was your, admiration for her enough that you didn't face that challenge?
I did. Well, with Kindred especially, I faced the challenge of I felt a lot of pressure to do right by Octavia Butler's legacy. She's a huge figure in science fiction, first successful African-American woman science fiction writer, first sci-fi writer to win a MacArthur Genius Grant. And just beyond that, a really important kind of American intellectual figure. And so like I'm a straight white guy and I did not want to in any way do damage or undermine the importance of her work and her legacy. So I felt a lot of pressure because of that. And the way I reacted to that when I did Kindred was I did invent things that weren't in the novel as kind of a framing device, which was really me being worried about cutting prose. So like I added this whole thing where the narrator is talking to you, the reader. So then I have to keep in all the narration. And it didn't work at all. But fortunately we had an editor named Sheila Keenan who did the exact kind of editing you're talking about. Where it is, their job to, in this case, not so much to make us look good, but to make the project look good and to make the project sort of carry the same weight and tell the story in the same way as the novel. And she was great about kind of cutting away the fat and the hesitation marks that I had in my original draft to get back to like the heart of the story. So by the time I got to working on these Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, I really did feel like I had a much better handle on how much prose a page can handle and how to identify elements in the story that were necessary and elements of the story that were, maybe reemphasizing something that had already been said before or were just kind of adding texture to the world building. But the John's art could, carry that same narrative weight. So it was definitely a learning process. And I was very lucky to have such strong collaborators in John and Sheila. And with Parable of the Talents, the artist David Brame did the layouts for the book. So with him as well.
It's kind of interesting that she chose two biblical titles.
Yeah.
For the books. Did she ever explain why she did that?
Yeah, well, it was in part, it comes out of the story because in Parable of the Sower, Lauren Olamina's dad is a reverend. He's a Baptist preacher who kind of runs a church in their walled off neighborhood that they live in. So her development of her Earthsea religion is actually like, it's not a rebellion against her dad because she never tells him about it, but it's very much going away from what her father was telling her. I think so there's that kind of ironic juxtaposition of the biblical names with a story that while it is a parable of a type of sower, and in this one it is a parable sort of about whether hiding or showing your talent, your gifts. It's entirely different and not actually a Bible story, but definitely because it's about a founding of a religion and because it comes out of a conflict about religions, it sort of makes sense in that way. It has a lot of like echoes to different themes in the stories.
So if you know the stories, you can kind of get an illusion from the choices?
I think so, yeah. I mean, the last page of each book is the actual parable from the Bible. And that's what she did in the novels as well. I think she's definitely encouraging you to sort of look at the parallels between the two. But I suspect just as much to look at the kind of stark contrasts as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. How long have you been working with this artist? Obviously, you've been working on at least three projects, and it sounds like you worked like four.
Actually, many projects. John and I have been working together for over 20 years now.
Wow.
And so we had another graphic novel before Kindred called The Whole Consumer Culture that was published 2008. By a small art book publisher. And then we've also done some curatorial work. We curated some art shows in the early 2000s that led to these two art books. One's called Black Comics, African American Independent Comics, Art and Culture, because we're both academics, so long titles. We did a follow-up to that in 2018 called Black Comics Returns. And both are just sort of kind of coffee table art books meant to showcase the thriving and growing subculture of Black independent comics artists.
So you were then a good choice to this because you understood Black culture reasonably well.
I mean, I hope I do. I definitely never want to take for granted that I'm a white guy and have certain privileges that people who do not look like me have. But I've spent a lot of my creative professional life trying to understand and talk about kind of race and identity politics and kind of the puzzle and the harm that it causes. Definitely like that was one reason why I was so enthusiastic about adapting Kindred to begin with and the other books is because Butler, she writes nuance very well. She writes complexity very well. Like she talks about things the way they actually are in an honest way and doesn't really sort of beat around the bush or try to sugarcoat anything. That's something I think I've always respected.
Because it's always interesting to me, and I think comics have a problem, as I keep telling people. I've read comics for several decades, and I've gotten to the place where I've read enough comics where when there's a male lead, I have a fair idea what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I've read them all. I've read basically every story that's possible with this over several decades. But when you put a woman lead in the front of it, I am lost. Because I haven't read enough women leads to have any idea what they're going to do. And frankly, I like that.
Yeah.
I like not knowing. I like having to pay attention and watch what they're going to do. But the trick is, as a writer, and you're talking about this at some levels, how does a person who is not of that lineage actually understand enough to be able to create that? And the only answer is, and I've asked several people, is research.
Yes.
Research, look into it, study it, to find out as much as you can about it. Because, you know, I've asked, people who have written or taken black characters and they're not black. And I said, well, how do you understand how to present that character? And they say, and that's the answer. Look into it, research, talk to people, find out what's going on. And I'm sure it sounds like you've done a lot of the research before you got to this. So that helped you bringing these to the printed page.
I think in a way, yeah. Yeah, it did. It definitely made me feel like I was not out of bounds to be working on the project because it fit pretty well with previous work I had done. Like you're saying, like I had done research that kind of dovetailed well with that project, with the Butler books. But research and talking to people is always key, and then just sort of showing the work to people getting honest opinions. For the Parable of Sower and Parable of Talents books, Abrams hired, and she was kind enough to do this, the horror writer Tanana Reeve Dew to look over my scripts because she teaches at least Parable of the Sower, in fiction class she teaches at, I think, UCLA, but like she had a lot of prior knowledge of the books. So, you know, she was a good resource to make sure I was focusing on the right parts and just sort of, you know, portraying the events of the books in a way that did justice to the books. So yeah, so just going along with what you're saying, yeah, research and just talking to people and like just being honest both with yourself and accepting other people giving you honest criticism, I think is an important part too.
So I'm glad to hear that you got, there were other people that looked at it, because, you know, I know this because I watched my roommate as a writer for comics and stuff like that. You do this in isolation largely. And yes. Most people cannot do it around a lot of other people talking or music playing or other things like that. You're basically on your own a lot of the time. And then here's this baby you have birthed and you have to give it to people, and their reaction, you're not always certain you're going to get the reaction you want from these people. So I'm glad to hear that you did that. I'm just curious, has there been any other reaction to these books that you have received, or any comments that people have told you after they've read your adaptation?
It's been like almost uniformly positive, to the extent of I don't know how to handle it. Like John and I always say with Kindred, like we were just shooting for people not hating us. Because like, so Butler's fans are we always compare them to like Beyonce's fandom online, you know, the like Beehive, very intense fandom. And Butler's fandom is like that, but they all have PhDs. And like, so we were like pretty cognizant of, you know, if we get this wrong, people will let us know. Yeah, for the most part, like it's been pretty uniformly positive. I think I really breathed a sigh of relief when, Butler's cousin, who's kind of in charge of the estate, first told us that she had read Kindred and she liked it. You know, so everything after that was just kind of gravy, I guess. But yeah, like it's people have really connected with the books. People have told me it's led them to go back and read the novels. People who read the novels have told me they felt like it was a, you know, really faithful adaptation. But at the same time, people who are into comics have, you know, given us feedback that it's good comics too, right? So it's that was, I think, something that was also really important to us, is that we did an adaptation that not only told the story in the way it needed to be told, but also, you know, did things that comics do well, did the kind of things that comics do better than other media.
Because there's a big difference between writing comics and writing like television or writing movies or those kinds of things. You have to deal with the printed page. And as such, that's a whole other way of doing things. So not only do you have to be careful as far as, you know, reaction from fans, but you also have to be able to make it work as a comic. So that is that's a skill, I have to say.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, with a novel, it's never a one-to-one thing. Like, you know, something that takes 10 pages in a novel, maybe you could do in a panel or something that was one sentence in a novel might take a long sequence to play out. So yeah, it's definitely its own thing. And it has presented different challenges, but I feel like I've definitely learned to do it better over these three books.
Now, are you also thinking about your artists? Cause artists often want to write or want to draw certain things. And sometimes the writer will cater their writing to what those people like to draw. Did you ever consult with your artists and ask, I mean, now we're going to get to this. What are you comfortable drawing? What would you prefer to draw?
Yes. Well, to some extent, we've known each other for so long. I'm pretty comfortable with just not so much with this project because we had editorial oversight and also, the estate needed to sign off on like the script, but in general, I'm usually pretty comfortable with, even if I give a long description of what I'd like to see visually, John knows me well enough that if he has a better idea, I'll be like, go with the better idea. I'm not very precious. Like, I'll give a lot of information in the scripts because I know John will take it all with a grain of salt. And if he can do a better job in a different way, sometimes we'll talk about it beforehand, but usually I'm just like, you know, go with your gut, do what you would prefer. I think probably one way I knew to cater to his art with these books was I tried to limit most pages to like max 6 panels. Just because John's art has a certain cartoony quality that when it gets smaller past 6 panels, I feel like it loses some of its, I don't know, kind of dynamic motion. Then with Parable of the Talents, we also had David Brame as the layout artist on the book. So that kind of brought in a different kind of collaboration, because, and I felt a little bad about it because he ended up working from a script I'd written expecting John to also do the layouts. But David and I had also worked together before, so I think that helped. And I do the thing that usually comics artists don't want comics writers to do, but I'll occasionally draw ideas for layouts that I put in my script. But again, because we had a longstanding working relationship, you know, I felt comfortable doing that, but not, you know, having them think like I it was a requirement that they follow my layout to the letter, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Now I'm looking on the AIPT Comics website, and they've got a preview of it, and they have a few of the pages in there.
Yes.
And the cover. Did John do the cover, or was somebody else doing the cover?
John did the cover, yeah.
Oh, wow. Cause that's a lot more defined, shall I say?
Yeah.
This artwork tends to be a little sketchier than, of course, comics. We're used to superheroes, and we have to understand exactly what's going on. There's not a lot of room for, you know, for interpretation, but he uses a lot of interpretation with it. And it's still, there'll be colors and stuff that don't necessarily stay within the lines, as it were. And so when he does that, of course, that's to fit a mood, is what I get from him.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting how that works with his stuff. And it's just fascinating to me. I'm always, you know, he does, if he changes the view of things. Like, there's one where there's a whole bunch of people in the room, and it's like he's got a fisheye lens on it.
Oh yeah.
And the pictures, the people are, you see that the heads a lot bigger than the bodies are as a result of that. And I found that really kind of interesting, because you get sort of a squashed feeling, like there was tension in the room when you did that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And there is tension in the room. So that's actually one reason for that. It's also the first meeting of this community the character sets up called Acorn. So the shape of the panel is a little acorn-ish, is another reason, you know, for that. But yeah, no, it's especially for how long the book is and how long each page takes. As we've worked through these projects, John's definitely taken on a more expressive style, and has really been thinking more, I think, about his line work, communicating mood and motion, more so than just straight, you know, like photorealism.
So how many pages are in the book? You brought up the fact that there was pages. How many pages are in this graphic novel?
I think it ended up being 288 pages of comics.
Okay.
With, you know, like back matter and stuff in addition, which was about, I think, 40 pages longer than Parable of the Sower. And then Parable of the Sower was, I think, another 50 or so pages longer than Kindred. So we always make this joke that we keep doing longer books. Maybe we should take a break from that. I don't know. But it labor intensive for sure.
Well, you know, people don't worry about the number of pages as if the story is being told.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Well, we have to worry about it because the page count's in our contract before we start.
Right. See, there's the rub.
Yeah.
So that's good. So how long did it take you guys? I mean, how long did it take you to work the script? And then was he doing the pages while you were also doing the script?
No. Well, this one, it was a little different. So I finished the script for Parable of the Sower. And that it went to John, and while he was starting to work on the art for Parable of the Sower, I started writing the script for Parable of the Talents. And I also do the lettering on the book. So I was lettering Parable of the Sower while working on the script for Parable of the Talents. So I will admit the timeline gets a little fuzzy in there of which one I was working on exactly when. But I remember very distinctly when I finished the script for Parable of the Talents, it was March 2020, just before the pandemic lockdowns.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, which is a strange feeling because it felt like I finished writing about the parables world and then went to live in it.
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of surreal. But the kind of combination of Parable of the Sower coming out in 2020, the pandemic and all lockdowns and delays and things that went with that. And then John, at the same time, was starting his line of books, Megascope, at Abrams.
Oh, wow.
So he was doing all that stuff. And then Marvel came calling for John, and he wrote Ghostlight. It was a miniseries he wrote for them. And he's been working on a nonfiction book with Angelique Roche about black comics characters in Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
All of which is to say, John had a bunch of stuff going on. There was a delay there too. Partially the reason David Brame came on the project was to give John some assistance and sort of get the project moving. So for this one, there was a bit of a delay between me finishing the script and production starting. But the script itself, I think I probably took about maybe 5 months to write, 5 or 6 months.
Okay.
Which was a lot longer than the previous scripts, but it was just a more difficult book. And also I knew we had a little leeway since the first book was still in the process of coming out.
Oh, that's good. So, and I just, because I don't know, is John a diverse creator?
John's black, yes.
Okay, so that helps explain a little bit about the style of the art and stuff like that. That's a little more, because I have there are certain artists you can kind of tell, but you kind of can't with some people, and I just never know. And so I have to ask those kinds of things. But interesting job.
Yeah, I don't know if you can tell what you can tell from his art, because it does vary from project to project as well. So like our Kindred book, he drew entirely with Sharpie.
Oh, wow.
Because he was trying to mimic a different kind of he was classically trained as a printmaker. And then he was trying to sort of mimic that with Sharpie and also kind of reference art styles like Kathy Kolowitz and like brutalist art styles to fit the subject matter. And then Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, he did all digitally, in part because it's like a comic set in the future, but also just because the digital art was like easier to do for long periods of time. He hurt his shoulder on Kindred. Anyway, all of which is to say, I think, we definitely work hard to make like every aspect that we work on serve the story more so than necessarily just our particular style, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you know, sometimes I think, and I'm probably going to get in trouble for this, is that sometimes I think if you have a more diverse background when it comes to creating art, you can translate that to the printed page a little more accurately.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that's incorrect, but I do think that it also just really depends on the person, you know? Because, the thing that always made sense to me was the idea of intersectionality, which defines your identity as sort of a node in a network of multiple different sort of worlds that you live in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's
mm-hmm.
not, it's socioeconomic status, like race, gender, sexuality, but then also just sort of who you grew up around and mm-hmm. you know, like so many things go into that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think at the same time, definitely John is like a really influential Afrofuturist artist and Afrofuturist mm-hmm. scholar mm-hmm. at this point in his career. So there's definitely like a strong focus on Black identity and identity politics mm-hmm. in his work and in the work we've done together. So I think it kind of goes both ways, like that you can sort of tell a lot about a person from the style of their work, but also you can sort of see how that changes, how people evolve.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the hair and the faces, I think, particularly. They look particularly like the person understands the look.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dare I say.
It's not like the old Marvel comics where like all the black people had like the one hairstyle or yeah.
No. Oh, I would look at those and go, boy, you know, I don't think that's accurate.
Yeah. I don't think anyone looks like that, but yeah.
Yeah. But he's got this one girl sitting, and I think she's studying or something. But the way her hair looks, it's not particularly together, but it looks right. It fits the circumstance and the person really well. And so, you know, to me, that's a person I think who understands what that's going to look like and how accurate that is as far as like, it's like somebody has seen that before and realizes, okay, this is the way that it really looks.
Oh, definitely. And, yeah.
And I get that. And I was happy to see that. And that's why I was kind of curious. Sometimes there are people of different backgrounds that can do that accurately, but not always. So I was just sort of curious if he brought that to him, because it makes a lot of sense when I look at the different people and different appearances and how he gets that. So that really, that probably was a huge help when he was drawing all this good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, and also just the source text, you know, figuring out visual ways to communicate the characteristics of the people, is one of the, like, I think kind of fun and exciting things, especially at the start mm-hmm. of one of these adaptations. And with the very sort of serious material, we take our joy where we can. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I know he has really enjoyed all the character design work. Mm-hmm. And like as we've gone from book to book, there's like also bigger and bigger casts of characters. So I'm glad that all that kind of is coming through.
Well, you know, it reminds me of, I was watching a European cartoon, and the character that lived in like Paris went over to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got to New York, everybody was grossly obese.
Oh, yeah. It's like the Triplets of Belleville. I remember.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. They're walking down the sidewalk, and I'm wondering how more they can get more than two people on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there and thinking, gosh, you know, do we really look like that to somebody from Europe? And I thought, well, you know, sometimes what they're doing is they're interpreting what they think is happening, and they accentuate to make a point or something like that. So yeah. I think that's what they were doing.
Yeah, it's kind of the work of like caricature, right? Where
right.
It's definitely also to communicate. I think in that example, especially kind of like a political critique or kind of a cultural satire.
Yeah. But it kind of bothered me though, because I thought, gosh, do we really look like that?
Yep.
You know, I fight my weight every day, and yet I hope I don't look like that walking down the street.
No. Yeah. No, but you can see that too with like China started trolling the idea of American manufacturing jobs with these AI videos online.
Yeah.
You seen those? Yeah. And you see a similar kind of stereotype being played out.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is that when I looked at his art, I got a sense that he understood the characters, and they looked realistic to me as opposed to other things that I've
read. Yeah.
So I thought that was something to do. And I was just sort of curious as to what background he was bringing to it, because it really did look very accurate. And I'm always fascinated by those kinds of things.
Yes. It's definitely a mix of just John's background, his training, and the requirements of the story.
That's great. Well, it really comes together and stuff like that. I'm going to look forward to getting it. I'm going to go pick it up and be able, I have to see if I can track down the first one first so I can read the whole story.
Oh, sure. But they work pretty well independently too.
Oh, that's good to know.
Because Butler really was a genius at what she did.
Oh, wow. Great. So that's good. So again, it's called Parable of the Talents, and it's an adaptation of Octavia E. Butler's original writing into comic graphic novel format. And Damien, I think you guys did a great job. I've seen, and I'm anxious to read more, it really is something, and I think we can probably, you know, no matter what perspective we come to, I think we'll pick up something to think about. And I love things that make me think. So I think I'll really enjoy this book because it really has a lot to say.
Oh, thank you so much. I hope you do.
Now, as far as what you're working on, of course, this is now out. Are there other projects you're working on that we should be aware of?
Yes. Well, John and I are working on another collaboration right now, but we're not really allowed to say what it is.
Okay.
Yet, but so we do have something like that coming out. Pretty recently, the publisher Rosarium Publishing crowdfunded a book called The Adventures of Lion Man that makes use of public domain superhero characters as a comic. John has a bunch of work in there, and so does David Brame. And that includes a short story that I wrote that David drew and John did the coloring on about the, what's his name? Fletcher Hanks character, Fantoma.
Okay.
So it's like a kind of reinterpretation of that public domain character. Anyway, that is available for pre-order right now. And there's a lot of like cool and interesting stuff about public domain superheroes in general, but especially different interpretations of Lion Man, who is maybe arguably the first black superhero, depending on how you define it.
Interesting, because, you know, to me, those early characters were tremendous fun. Now, a couple of them survived.
Yeah.
But, you know, DC right now is bringing the Justice Society back.
Yeah, they bring them back around every once in a while.
Yeah, but they don't want them to lay fallow too long, because they're afraid somebody will pick them up and start doing stuff with them that they don't particularly care for.
Right.
But the guy who's writing that book, the JSA book, is Jeff Lemire, and he's doing a very good job. He's blending all these different Justice Society versions into one, and I'm enjoying it.
You can never go wrong with Jeff Lemire, I think. I haven't found a book of his I didn't enjoy.
He's terrific. I interviewed him a long time ago when he was doing Animal Man way back in D.C.
Oh, yeah.
When they started the New 52. And I was always interested in the fact that a lot of the stories he writes have to do with family.
That's true.
That's something comics avoid like the plague. They're terrified that somebody's going to end up in a long-term relationship.
Oh,
they
I want know. Them
so they bounce around. It drives me to distraction.
Well, Parable of the Talents is also an epic family drama. So you got that going for you, too.
Oh, good. That'll be excellent, because I like those kind of things. I don't think that many people, as are in the comics, are single that long. So I like to see something that's different. And they talk about diversity. Well, let's have some married people in there for a little bit.
Yeah. That's what I always like, a married Spider-Man. Like, I was glad that he's married in Ultimate Spider-Man these days.
I won't dwell on that, but they unmarried him.
Yeah, I did not care for that.
Mephisto comes in and rips them apart, and I wrote a column, because I read a column for the website for Major Spoilers. And I said, I talked about the fact that should Spider-Man be married? I said, yes, we haven't seen it. It's like Batman and Catwoman were trying to get married for a while, and then at the last second, they jumped off in different directions in the night. And I sat there and went, what? They've been building up to this for months, and I haven't read Batman stories where he's married, so I was kind of interested.
Yeah.
And based on Superman and Lois, which is, you know, a happily married, God, I love that stuff.
That was like the best. I mean, part of it might be like I'm a dad, so Superman dad is like Mm-hmm. I'm like, yes, yes, you don't know what you're doing either. It's okay that I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, what got me was Superman knows how to save the world. He knows how to use his powers, but he doesn't know how to handle two teenage right. sons. I thought
so
that was
interesting, right?
That was yeah. funny. He's learning. He's growing still and doing stuff. So I enjoyed that.
Yes.
I'm glad they do that kind of in the comics. That marriage has not been – Mephisto hasn't been over in the DC universe yeah. recently.
Yeah, I think Superman's better off for that.
I really like it. Real quickly, I'll tell you a story. Kurt Busiek wrote a story one time where Superman, Clark Kent, was being told because he's been so busy being Superman, he hasn't been living up to his expectations in the Daily Planet. And so Perry White says to him, okay, this is your last chance. You got to write a story by the end of today or you're fired. And, of course, Superman comes calling and he's got to go off and save the world. And late at night, he comes back into the back home and he goes to Lois, well, that's it. I'm fired. I didn't get my story done. And Lois yeah. turned to him and said, yes, you did. And he goes, what? No, I didn't. He said, yeah, I ghosted it for you. So you still have a job. And I was so blown away by that even Superman needs help every once in a while.
Yes.
I saw Kurt Busiek at a convention one time and I told him that was one of my very favorite Superman stories because that was so great. I love that. So anyway, enough about that. But I like that kind of stuff in there too. So that being a family drama, that's going to really intrigue me. So I'm going to be looking forward to getting these books and see how this turns out.
But yeah.
I think, Damien, you guys did a great job with this book and what I can see. And of course, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thanks so much.
And if you haven't read it yet, I highly recommend you get to the local bookstore. And either that or go to Amazon. I'm sure they'll have it there and other places. So
Bookshop.org. That's a good one.
Yeah, all kinds of good places to do it. And I think, Damien, you're off to a good start. And I'm looking forward to the next project. Maybe we'll get to talk when the new one comes.
I hope so.
Calling.
Yeah.
It'll be lots of fun to see what different muscles you get to stretch the next time.
Yes.
See how things
yeah,
go.
I'm looking forward to it.
Because I love variety, and I think this is a great book that's going to scratch that itch for me. So I really appreciate it. So keep up the wonderful stuff, Damien. I can't wait to read your next stuff.
Thank you so much.
If you're enjoying this show, I would greatly appreciate your support. For $5 a month, you can ensure I'm able to bring you interviews with comic creators week after week. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out that address, again, patreon.com/majorspoilers, for more information. Thanks in advance. And that's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.